Belgic Confession 37 on the Last Judgment. Finally, we believe, according to the Word of God, when the time appointed by the Lord, which is unknown to all creatures, is come, and the number of the elect complete, that our Lord Jesus Christ will come from heaven, corporally and visibly, as he ascended with great glory and majesty, to declare himself judge of the quick and the dead, burning this old world with fire and flame to cleanse it. Last week's class was entitled Change in Old Testament Law in Ezekiel 40 through 48. We noticed that there would be changes, Ezekiel is telling us in his vision, there would be changes in Old Testament civil law, and especially ceremonial law, loads of them. Not changes, of course, to God's moral law, which is literally, as well as metaphorically, set in stone. These changes were changes regarding the Holy Land. Exhibit A, one of the handouts. Changes in the Holy Land. Changes in the tribal allotments, changes in the land for the prince and the priests and the Levites, changes regarding Jerusalem and the temple, changes in the cities of refuge and the other 42 cities that were given to the Levites or priests. There were changes not only to the Holy Land, but the holy officials, the priests and the Levites, especially in that there was to be no high priest. And we looked at the clothing changes and the changes regarding who they could or couldn't marry. We noticed changes in the holy furniture, far fewer items, only two in Ezekiel's temple, whereas the Mosaic Tabernacle had six and Solomon's temple 32. And we notice changes in the holy times. Some of the holy times were no more, such as Pentecost, the Day of Atonement, the blowing of trumpets, and the evening offering, as well as the seven-year rest for land. And we noticed two new feasts, both in the first month on days number 1 and 7. The holy sacrifices changed too with regard to those that were allotted for the feasts, and there were changes with regard to the amounts of the meal offering and the drink offering. So now, after spending two classes giving seven reasons why Ezekiel 40 through 48 is not to be interpreted literally, we're spending three classes on the positive meaning of the passage, which we've summed in these three words. The one we looked at last week, law; this week, better; and next week, Lord willing, fulfillment. If only everything in life could be summed up in just one word. Changes in the Old Testament law last week. Tonight's class is on better. This is our penultimate class this season. And next week on the fulfillment of Ezekiel 40 through 48, which will be the culmination of it all. And our last class before family visitation in May, Lord willing. Now, let's focus on this word better. Which book of the Bible especially deals with better?
Hebrews.
It deals with the word better and the reality of better. Jesus Christ, the opening chapters of Hebrews teach us, is better, far better, infinitely far better than the angels or Moses or Aaron or Joshua. He belongs to a better priesthood than Aaron, and provides a better sacrifice, and inaugurates a better covenant with better promises, and a better hope. Now, what about the word better in Ezekiel 40 through 48? Is the word better there? And you're reading through it probably several times by now. Did you notice the word better? No, the word better isn't to be found in Ezekiel 40 through 48. It actually only occurs once in the whole book, chapter 36, verse 11. But readers and students of Ezekiel 40 through 48 would grasp the idea of better that certainly is the teaching of these nine chapters. Let me give you a quote from a modern writer, Douglas Stewart, in his commentary on Ezekiel. This is Stewart with the letter U. He writes, page 367 of his commentary, quote, "The visions of Ezekiel 40 through 48 are not designed to encourage the Israelites to expect a restoration of the life they have enjoyed before the conquest and exile, but to anticipate a much better order of things brought about supernaturally by the Lord." So in my own thinking of this, I thought better sums it up, and then I was encouraged to say that Douglas Stewart said the same thing, and if he agrees with you, you know you're on the right side. It's not just moderns, but here we have a quote from the early church making the same point, and we have Jerome. As Martin Luther said, Jerome is no good on the subject of free will. He's terrible on it, but he was a pretty useful Bible commentator. These are the words of Jerome. "This temple," Ezekiel 40 through 48, "this temple, which is now described with the order of the priesthood and division of the land and its fertility, is much superior." He could have been translated better. "It's much superior, much superior to that which Solomon built, whereas the one which was built under Zerubbabel was so small and so unworthy of comparison with the earlier one that they who had seen the first temple and now looked on this wept." So we have Douglas Stewart, a modern, saying Ezekiel 40 through 48 is much better and much superior is the term used of the translation of Jerome. And then, of course, better being a comparative, Ezekiel 40 through 48 describes a state of things that is much better than what? The Jerome quote points us in the right direction. Ezekiel 40 through 48 is much better than anything before Ezekiel's ministry. It's much better than what we have described in Genesis post-fall or in the writings of Moses. It's much better than the state of affairs obtaining at the end of the book of Joshua, or during the reign of Israel's first godly king, David, or even Solomon himself. Remember, the high point in the Old Testament. And then after that, the kingdom was divided into the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. And then eventually, Jerusalem and the temple were destroyed 14 years before Ezekiel penned chapters 40 through 48. So what Ezekiel's picturing in these last nine chapters of the book is better than anything which came before his ministry. But all parties would agree that Ezekiel 40 through 48 is better also than the rest of Old Testament history after he penned these words. Ezekiel 40 through 48 pictures a better world for God's people than the return from the captivity under Zerubbabel, then Ezra, then Nehemiah, or when Zerubbabel's temple was built, or during the 400 silent years. Ezekiel 40 through 48 is obviously better than anything that came heretofore since the fall. And Lord willing, next week we're going to nail down precisely better than what and much more fully, but that will wait. Let's begin now to break down the various aspects that are better. And again, we follow our standard procedure, beginning with the easier things. Ezekiel 40 through 48 describes a better land from that which Ezekiel was exiled when he was aged just 25. And here we turn to the handout of the map. Now, think of Israel's sad history in and before Ezekiel's day. This map says this much, it says more, but it says there's going to be a restoration of the exiled tribes, the 10 northern kingdom tribes, which were taken to captivity in 2 Kings 17, and the 2 southern kingdom tribes in 2 Kings 25. All 12 tribes will be reunited under one prince, which at last happened in Solomon's day. And interestingly, 3 of the tribes of the northern kingdom, Issachar, Zebulun, and Gad, are actually south of the southern tribes. So the way they're constituted, you couldn't really break them up again the way they had been broken up before. Better land. Now, looking at this map more closely and comparing this with the division of the land at the end of Joshua's life, how do they compare size-wise? Which is bigger? Ezekiel's is bigger. It looks like, it's not to scale, but it looks like something like twice the size. Ezekiel's has the 12 tribes occupying land of about twice the area in Joshua's day. What about the borders between the various tribes? I'm looking for one word that describes the borders between the various tribes. They are all they're all parallel, or we could say they're all straight. They're all straight. There's no reference to the borders between the tribes, as you know, draw a line from the stone of Bohan to the ascent of this hill and that particular craggy rock over there, like you get in the book of Joshua. And one would assume that this would lead to fewer border disputes. Although on the other hand, you think to yourself, what about a river? Let's say a river that squiggles a bit, and you might have territory on both sides of the river several times. What we have here in Ezekiel's map is more like the division of land, let's say, in the US state of Iowa, where they're all planned out beforehand and nicely in grids and straight lines. Much more like Iowa than, let's say, Delaware, or somewhere where I grew up higgledy-piggledy without any central planning. Notice, too, that in the Ezekiel map, there are no tribes within the allotments of other tribes, such as in Joshua's day,
Simeon and Judah.
Simeon was inside Judah. In Ezekiel's map, there are no cities in other tribal allotments. Manasseh, according to Joshua 17, Manasseh had cities or towns inside the tribal allotments of Issachar and Asher. That must get quite complicated after a while. And then, of course, there are no cities in the midst of all the other tribes for the priests and the Levites. There were 48 cities given to priests and Levites throughout all the various other 12 tribes. Instead, back of the first handout we're looking at, the priest's land and the Levite's land is entirely consolidated. It's all in the one place. And if you're a farmer, you're best to have all your land consolidated. When I was a boy, there was a guy called Silver Neil, and he had wee bits of land here and there, and he had to go on journey between them, and Silver would have been delighted if he could have got his land consolidated. But the wee half acre there and another acre. Anyway, a better day for the priests and the Levites. With the new Ezekielian map or division of land, there will be no quarrel over Jerusalem, because Jerusalem used to be divided between two tribes, namely
Judah and Benjamin.
Now the Jews and the Palestinians want to divide it up, but that's a different matter. In fact, now the city, which practically everybody takes to be Jerusalem, the city is not in Judah or Benjamin. It's not actually in anybody's tribal allotment. So that's the end of all rows. Moreover, this city, God will not leave this city in Ezekiel 40 through 48, as he did in which chapters of Ezekiel? Remember the big section? Ezekiel 8 through 11, and especially at the end of chapter 11, God leaves the city because of its sins. But God isn't going to leave the city in Ezekiel 40 through 48. And the last words of Ezekiel, found in Ezekiel 48, verse 35, regarding that city is, the Lord is there. And that's a whole lot better. You couldn't have said regarding Jerusalem in Ezekiel's day, the Lord is there, because he wasn't there. His glory left the city on a chariot pulled by heavenly angels. We're dealing here in Ezekiel with a better land. Let's go further along this theme, noting that there will be no alienation of land. No alienation of land. Turn with me, please, to Ezekiel 46. Ezekiel 46. Look at verses 16 through 18. Thus saith the Lord God, if the prince give a gift unto any of his sons, the inheritance thereof shall be his sons. It shall be their possession by inheritance. But if he give a gift of his inheritance to one of his servants, then it shall be his to the year of Jubilee, of liberty, which I take to be the 50th year, Jubilee. And after that 50th year, the land shall return to the prince. But his inheritance shall be his sons for them. They can hold on to the inheritance. It won't revert back. So that's the prince giving his own land. Then verse 18 says, moreover, the prince shall not take of the people's inheritance by oppression, to thrust them out of their possession. What is the classic example in the Old Testament of a prince, or more precisely his wife, doing this very thing? Jezebel did it to please old moping Ahab. And she stole, by murder, she stole Naboth's vineyard in 1 Kings chapter 21. And the purpose of this legislation, to finish off verse 18, the purpose is, but he, the prince, shall give his son's inheritance out of his own possession, so that my people be not scattered, every man from his possession. And you can imagine these tribal laws about who owned the land. And after a while, by people changing boundary markers, and by the kings, besides other wealthy men, oppressing people and taking their land, one can imagine that a few hundred years after the book of, after the death of Joshua, the land wasn't divided up the way it was supposed to be. And this got worse and worse. And Ezekiel says, in the better day, this problem is going to be solved. So there will be no alienation of land involving the prince. And there will also be no alienation of land involving the Levites. Chapter 48, verse 14. Chapter 48, verse 14. They, that is, the priests and the Levites, shall not sell of it, that is, of the land to be given them in Ezekiel 40, the priests and the Levites, they shall not sell of it, neither exchange it, nor alienate the first fruits of the land, the best parts of the land, for it is holy unto the Lord. So the priest and the Levite couldn't even temporarily alienate, sell or exchange their land, or any little bit of their land, which was allowed for in the Mosaic law, but now it will always be the priests and Levites permanently. And this to us seems like a very small part, even if we're able to understand it. But in Ezekiel's day, people thought, that's a whole lot better. This is, we're going to get rid of old injustices and the land is going to be there in perpetuity. This is good, I like this. Preach it, brother. Tell us about this glorious thing. We not only have a better land, but we have, and now you realize we're going over, like last week and other classes, we're going over the same broad headings from a different angle. There will be a better temple. Remember, Ezekiel is a priest. And he's interested in the better temple. There's going to be a better temple in the midst of a better land. And now, of course, we're thinking especially of the second handout. Now, here are some general observations regarding this temple complex. The size of the temple complex. It is about 1 mile by 1 mile. So I imagine most, if not all of you, can think of your house, let's say, and you can think of a mile. And from our house to the end of the Listonan Road, that's a mile. That's a fair degree. And then another mile, a mile. So it's a square mile. What do you think? Is that bigger than the temple area for Solomon's temple and Herod the Great's temple? It is. Bigger and better. What about the shape of the temple compound? Square. Unlike the tabernacle complex, which was oblong, and square is more perfect than an oblong, and unlike the temples of Solomon and Zerubbabel and Herod the Great. What about the elevation of this temple? Fruchtenbaum, a dispensationalist writer, he says that this whole temple complex, and indeed the central reserve with the territory for the priests and the Levites and the city, etc., around it, it has become the highest mountain on the world. A plateau, which of course, if that's as high, let's say, as higher than Mount Everest, and you're not that far from sea level beneath you, I mean, it's going to be pretty steep, but you've got a flat plateau upon it. So this is the highest part in the whole world. And then, though we're not talking massive increments here, then when you enter the outer court, you go up how many steps?
Seven.
You go up seven. And then when you go into the inner court, you go up
eight
steps. But of course, you're really in the highest mountain in the world, so once you get up there, that's just a breeze. And then, if you were going to the altar, let's say if you were a priest, you would go up a few more steps. Or if you were going into the temple building proper, chapter 40, verse 49 says there were steps by the pillars. We're not told how many steps up to the altar or into the temple building proper. But we have this Huge temple complex, bigger than anything before. Its shape is square, and it's literally on the top of the world. And then as you get nearer to God in the temple, you keep going up, 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 up the altar, or up as you go into the holy temple itself. It's a better temple. And what about the temple building itself? Now, at the end of chapter 40 of Ezekiel, in the opening four verses of chapter 41, you end up with the Holy of Holies being 20 cubits, and in the holy place, 40 cubits, and in the portico or vestibule, 11 cubits, and it's 20 cubits broad. And then it's 20 cubits broad too with Solomon, but Solomon's is 20 plus 60 plus 20. So Solomon's temple was actually slightly bigger in terms of numbers. But there's one thing that limits that a little. Sam and I were talking about it earlier. It's the relative size of the cubit. We're specifically told that the cubit in Ezekiel, the elbow to the tip of the middle finger, is a cubit and a hand breadth. So Solomon's temple was bigger, but the cubits apparently aren't exactly the same. And then let's add this with the factor that inside Ezekiel's temple, how many pieces of furniture were there inside Ezekiel's temple? Two, no, one, because there were two pieces of furniture, but the altar was outside the temple building, it's in the temple complex. So this one, which is slightly smaller, has one piece of furniture in Solomon's, inside Solomon's temple, or sorry, Ezekiel's temple. How many pieces of furniture, it's been a long day, how many pieces of furniture was inside Solomon's temple? Two freestanding angels and the Ark of the Covenant in the Holy of Holies. That makes three, right? Then we go into the holy place. We've got ten tables of showbread, ten candlesticks, and the altar of incense is 21. 3 plus 21, 24. So the building itself of Solomon's was bigger, but in that there were 24 pieces of furniture in it, and there was only one piece of furniture in Ezekiel's temple. If you had walked into the two, which one would you have thought was bigger? You would have thought Ezekiel's temple is bigger. So there we are. For what it's worth, I'm not resting a whole lot on that. So we've looked at the temple complex, that square that's on here, and then the temple building itself, which is center and just a bit to the west of center. What about security and sanctity? Security and sanctity go together in this temple because sanctity or holiness is ensured by security. You keep the right sort of people out and you allow the right sort of people who are a different sort of people in. The walls around the temple complex were, and it depends how you measure a cubit, cubit here, there were six cubits, if you cubit in a hand's breadth, and how big is a hand breadth, but the walls around the temple compound were, at least by my reckoning, about 11 feet thick. Is that a thick wall? 11 feet thick. What's the average thickness for a castle? I mean, I don't know, would they be 11 feet thick?
No.
I wouldn't have thought.
Not at the bottom of the way.
Maybe at the bottom it's going to be really high. It would get near that, but maybe. So they're 11 feet thick. Chapter 40, verse 5 says these walls are 11 feet thick and they're 11 feet high. That doesn't actually strike us as that far, but it's more of people coming through it than over it. And then we have three outer gates on the north, south, and east of the temple compound. And chapter 40 verse 14 says that the gates or at least this particular gate, and I take this to be the same for them all, how high were these gates? Chapter 40, verse 14. So there were 60 cubits, and a cubit is a foot and a half, that's 90 feet. And then there's the how wide is somebody's hand? So maybe it's 100 to 110 feet, maybe it's 36, 37 yards, maybe it's 33 meters. So if you have a wall and it's 11 feet high, this does look rather strange, doesn't it? You've got 11 feet high for a wall, and then you've got a gate, one of them, which I take the same for them all, because the gates are actually the same in all other regards. So the wall's about 11 feet high, and the gates are 110 feet high, 10 times higher. One wonders if this is really supposed to be literal, although we've done a lot more than wonder if it was literal. So about 30, 31, 32, 33 meters high. How high is this building at the top? It's nowhere near 30, 33 meters. And then these gates are long, not only high, but they're long. And there's little chambers beside them, and there's windows that narrow in. And someone who's coming in has to pass through these windows. Now do think about castles and murder holes and that sort of thing. You're in a really dangerous position if you're coming through there and somebody on the inside wants to keep you from entering. And then there are little rooms there where the guards can come out. This is the point. The point of this passage is not, I wonder how we're going to make all this big long gate with all these little grooves and spaces and where the guards actually stood. The point is, this place is incredibly secure. Nothing that defiles is going to get in anymore, unlike the bad old days. So a long gateway, and it's very high. There are windows, there are Levitical guards. Let's turn to chapter 44, verses 6 through 9. Chapter 44, 6 through 9. Thou shalt say to the rebellious, even to the house of Israel, thus saith the Lord God, O ye house of Israel, let it suffice you of all your abominations. You've done enough of them, no more abominations. In that, and here's the chief abomination that God puts his finger on, ye have brought into my sanctuary strangers who are uncircumcised in heart and uncircumcised in flesh. You brought them in to be in my sanctuary, to pollute it, even my house, when ye offer my bread, the sacrifices, the fat and the blood. And they have broken my covenant because of all your abominations. Ye have not kept the charge of mine holy things, but ye have set keepers of my charge in my sanctuary for yourselves. Well, so-and-so, he's a friend of mine. Ox, you can come on in. Again, like what the liberal churches do when they don't discipline somebody for sin because he's a good giver, or because he runs the chemist in the town. It wouldn't do to have a man like that under discipline. Who cares if he's run off with somebody else's wife? The really important thing is not God's church. It's keeping him on board. Because his family have been in our church for at least 10 generations. Thus saith the Lord God, verse 9. No stranger, uncircumcised in heart, nor uncircumcised in flesh, shall enter into my sanctuary of any stranger that is among the children of Israel. And then verse 10 talks about the Levites. And verse 11 says, the Levites shall be my ministers in my sanctuary, having charge at the gates of the house, spoken of so much in chapters 40 and 41, and ministering to the house. They're going to be the porters, the gatekeepers, to keep ungodly people out. And so if the Gentiles have to be circumcised in heart and flesh, it's obviously the case to get in. It's obviously the case the Jews are going to have to be uncircumcised or circumcised in heart and flesh to get in. These three gates around the outer, well, there were also three gates into the inner court. So there was another layer of defense. Thick walls, high gates. You've got to run the gauntlet to go through these three outer gates. And then if you're a priest, even then you've got to go through the gates to get into the inner court. And this is a whole lot better. And this passage, when it was read, any spiritual-minded person who understood the goings-on at the temple said, boy, this is my sort of church. This is the way things should be. I like the sound of that. Preach it, Ezekiel. Preach it, man. Now, let's talk about the temple building. Let's say someone, the right sort of someone, he's a priest, and he comes through the inner gate, the outer gate, then the inner gate. And then he goes into the temple. Well, when he enters the portico, the first of the three entrings, it's 14 cubits wide. This is at the very end of chapter 40 and the very start of chapter 41. So it's 14 cubits wide. Then when he enters the Holy of Holies, the entrance is 10 cubits wide. And the Holy of Holies itself, it's 6 cubits wide. So it keeps going down by 4 cubits because it's narrower. Because you're coming closer, ever closer, to the living God. And now let's read chapter 43, 1 through 5. Chapter 43, 1 through 5. Ezekiel has been on a guided tour in chapters 40, 41, 42 in the temple complex. Afterward, 43 verse 1 says, he brought me to the gate, even the gate that looketh toward the east. And remember, God left the tabernacle and the temple and the city of Jerusalem by going east. And now he's looking towards the east, and the glory of the God of Israel came from the way of the east. He's coming back the way he left. And his voice was like the noise of many waters, and the earth shined with his glory. And then Ezekiel tells us in verse 3 that this was the exact same glory of the Lord that he saw in Ezekiel 1 and Ezekiel 3 by the river Kebar, and indeed the same glory that he speaks of in chapters 8 through 11 when the glory of the Lord left, because this book's a remarkable unity. Now in chapter 43, and we can add 44, the glory now has come back from the east. Verse 4, the glory of the Lord came into the temple by the way of the gate whose prospect is toward the east. So the Spirit took me up and brought me into the inner court. And he's looking west now, and Ezekiel says, behold, the glory of the Lord filled the temple. God's glory returns after leaving in chapters 8 through 11. And so we have in the book of Ezekiel two guided tours in which Ezekiel is guided around the temple. Chapters 8 through 11, he's guided around in chapter 8, all the abominations in the temple. He says, look at this, Ezekiel. This is what they're doing in the temple court here. And Ezekiel's disgusted, and God says, but Ezekiel, it's worse than that. And then he shows him another one. He goes, there's more idolatry going on. She takes them to 4 idolatrous sites in this vision. And then in chapter 9, 6 angels come in and slaughter people around the temple for their wicked sin. And Ezekiel sees this. He sees the bloody corpses in the temple. And because of this, God leaves. And now in Ezekiel 40 through 48, at the very beginning of this passage, there's another guided tour around the temple, the temple complex. Ezekiel moves through this gate, and he goes up this way, and he goes around another way. And Ezekiel was thinking to himself, boy, this is very different from chapters 8 through 11. This is positive, and this is much better. This is better than it's ever been before. And now, instead of God leaving, he sees at the end of his vision, God is there. And holiness and worship in this temple, as opposed to sin and idolatry in chapters 8 through 11. And he's saying, this is a lot better. Ezekiel 43, verses 6 through 9. Now he brings out, if God is going to dwell in the temple, kings must no longer encroach upon temple property. Verse 6, I heard him, that is God, speaking unto me out of the temple. God is now in the holy place. And the man, the measuring angel, stood by me. And he said unto me, that is God, from within the temple, Son of man, the place of my throne. God is now sitting enthroned in the temple. And the place of the soles of my feet. His feet are, as it were, on the floor of the temple. Where I dwell in the midst of the children of Israel forever. And my holy name, the house of Israel, shall no more defile, neither they, the people, nor their kings, and they won't defile me, the people or their kings, by their whoredom, idolatry, nor by the carcasses of their kings in their high places. Because evidently they were burying kings, the kings of Judah, on temple property. It goes on to say, in their setting of their threshold by my thresholds, and their post or doorposts by my doorposts, and the wall between me and them. They have even defiled my holy name by their abominations that they have committed. Wherefore I have consumed them in mine anger. Think of the fall of Jerusalem and the destruction of Solomon's temple. Now let them put away their whoredom and idolatry, and the carcasses of their kings far from me, and I will dwell in the midst of them forever. In the past, the kings were encroaching on the temple area and having themselves buried in that sacred land. And God says that's over. And then a lot of people with conscience who feared the Lord said, that's a lot better. I always thought God was offended by that wicked behavior. And then the next few verses, 10 and 11, it refers to the spiritually minded in Israel, Israel's contemporaries to whom he preached and wrote this message, and people thereafter. Thou son of man, verse 10, show the temple to the house of Israel, so that they may be ashamed of their iniquities, and let them measure the pattern. Think of this great temple, measure it out and see how it all fits together. And then, if they're ashamed of all they've done and they're pained over their sins, show them some more. Tell them more about this glorious temple. Show them the design of the house and all the different arrangements of it, and how you enter and exit with these gates and all the security that there's going to be, and all the ordinances and the forms and the laws, and write it in their sight so that they may keep the whole form thereof and keep it in mind, and all these divine laws about holiness, and do them. And then verse 12 says, this is the law of the temple. Upon the top of the mountain, this high holy mountain, the whole area surrounding it shall be most holy. That's the point. Keep certain people out. Keep away defilement with carcasses and people getting buried in the wrong places in my sacred territory. This is the law of the temple. Pause a second. It's a better land and a better temple. Do you feel that the vision is expanding and you're beginning to grasp more what the prophet is getting at? I hope so. I'm seeing some heads nod, because I'm kind of scared. It's a moment of truth. Are people getting this, or am I just way off on my own here and in danger? Let's move to our next section. There is a better service at this temple in the heart of the land. Better religious service. There are better people there than ever in Israel's history. Better people. The priests are now only Zadokites. Only Zadokites, the most faithful ones. Chapter 44, verses 15 and 16 teach this. And according to verses 17 and 18, the people will be wearing linen garments, which are lighter. There'll be no wool. And this means that they will not, what's the word in verse 18? They won't sweat. No sweating. And sweating, of course, began with the fall. Sweating began with the fall. So no sweating. And then the clothes have been introduced. Verse 19 says the priests have a nice place where they can change their clothes when they move from the inner court to the outer court. There's special chambers for them. And you say, that's better too. It wasn't as nicely spelled out like that in any of the older temples. The Levites, well, the Levites, these were better Levites, because though many Levites erred in the past, in some regards, especially around the day of Ezekiel, a few decades before and afterwards, the priests actually, in some ways, were better than the Levites. Though the Levites, many of them have erred in the past, the Levites have learned their lesson, and we're not only going to have better priests, but we're going to have better Levites. The people of God are saying, that's good, because I was troubled by some of the wicked leaders we had at the temple in the days of old. And the prince, unlike most of the princes in Jerusalem, the prince will be godly. Chapter 45, verse 9 tells us that he will execute judgment. And he will, at least this is how I read verses 10 through 12, the priest is going to see to it that there will be just weights and measures in Israel. Now, is there anyone in this room who has ever been troubled by the use of unjust weights and measures? You ever felt you were ripped off by unjust weights and measures? Probably not, and you've given the right answer. Because now we don't come in with a set of scales, and there's a guy who's got a light set of scales and a heavy set of scales, and he uses them when he's buying, he uses a different set of scales, or different weights on the scales. But back then, when you didn't have standardized, maybe electronic measurements, this was a major way of stealing. But this was a big issue for the prophets, and they would often, and actually in Proverbs 2, sinful, wicked weights and measures. But now we've got a godly priest, and he's going to oversee things. And for them, this was important. And then there are more regulations regarding the priest, as well as ones we have that we've mentioned earlier. The priest, he isn't allowed to enter the temple compound through any of the eastern gates, the inner and the outer gate, because Jehovah has passed through those. And that's sort of now closed up. And he has to go in through the north or the south, just like everybody else. And in chapter 46, verses 8 through 10, whenever the feast comes, he's not to be aloof with the people. He's to enter with the people. So he's not some sort of demigod that's above everybody else. He's one of the saints of God with them. So better people, the priests are all Zadokites, the Levites have learned their lesson, we've got a godly prince, and the Israelites are all circumcised in body and heart. Because as I mentioned earlier, you can't have higher qualifications for the Gentiles than for the Israelites. And you should be thinking to yourself, boy, if I was an Old Testament saint, I would really have liked the church of my day to be like that. That's a sort of congregation from an Old Testament perspective that I'd like to be part of. There was also a better provision of materials for the offerings at the set times. See, the law of Moses says that the morning and evening offering, and on the Sabbath, and on the new moon, and all the various yearly feasts, both the pilgrimage feasts and the non-pilgrimage feasts, there were certain set offerings that had to be offered. And then the question is, who has to cough up for these? The law of Moses doesn't actually say. Now, if you had a godly king would say, we've been promised to bring on to the Lord's blessings, I'll take care of that. But at other times, But now, chapter 45, verses 13 through 16, tell us that the people have to give a certain proportion of various goods to the prince. Chapter 45, verses 13 through 16. They give a 60th of their product of wheat and barley, and 100th of their olive oil, verse 14, and 200th, one out of every 200 lambs, and they then give it to the prince. And then the prince, verse 17 says, the prince then gives to the priests or Levites for the sacrifices, sort of on behalf of the whole congregation at the set time. So everything's laid out, there's no misunderstandings, it'll all be provided for, and everybody knows their role. So it's some people don't think, well, I'm ending up giving too much, and he's not giving enough, and this one's trying to diddle me. And everybody goes, that's a good law. Wow, I like that. That's better. And then we have tables. Did anyone notice in their reading through Ezekiel 40 through 48 a nice reference to tables? Well, Ezekiel 40, verses 39 through 43, describe slaughter tables for sacrifices. It's number 14 on the handout. And they are found just by the sides of the northern inner gate. So we have eight hewn stone tables with instruments and hooks. And nothing like that was said regarding Moses' tabernacle or Solomon's temple. And now specifically built in are these stone tables, and they've been particularly hewn. They're nice and flat, and they're good and sturdy. They're not going to collapse. And then you've got little hooks with instruments on there, and you say, well, that's a whole lot better. That we should have done that right at the start. And the priests are going, boy, that's fair and handy. In the same way you'd say if you come into a kitchen that looked particularly well laid out and designed, you'd say, wish I'd have thought of that. And there's a better altar. Not just better facilities for preparing the sacrifices, you could butcher them, but there's a better altar. The altar is smaller than Solomon's, but this altar, spoken of in the second half of Ezekiel 43, has a nicer tiered shape. It sort of tilts, it goes inwards, and there are ledges on it, and there are stairs specifically mentioned, unlike any of the other brazen altars mentioned in the Bible, and they faced east with the rising sun and where God came back. And then, rather than just splattering the blood in specific places, you splattered the blood on sides and on ledges and so forth. And the priests would look at that and say, that's a better way of doing it. And then you have 7 days for cleansing this temple and specific sacrifices. Moses' altar, all you needed to do was put anointing oil on it, really. That was it, sanctified. This one, you need 7 days. And unlike the 7 days consecration of the altar at Solomon's temple, there's all sorts of elaborate rites. And so many sacrifices on day one, so many on day two. And it's all laid out. And the people who heard that says that's a better altar. And not just the bloody sacrifices, but there were two offerings that were non-bloody offerings that accompanied the bloody sacrifices in Old Testament sacred ritual. What are the two offerings that were non-bloody?
The meal offering and the drink offering.
The meal offering and the drink offering, which drink offering was of wine. And the meal offering and the drink offering, they've increased. When you offer a certain sacrifice of a particular animal, and Moses said you've got to give a certain amount of meal offering. Well, now you give a larger meal offering with the particular animals and a larger drink offering. And again, the key word is, that's better too. And then we have kitchens. Anyone here think that it's better to have good and lots of kitchens? Think so? Good. Well, there were kitchens built into the design of the temple. There were kitchens for the priests. And the kitchens for the priests are numbers 20. You see them about along the left hand or west hand or west side. And they're in the inner court because that's where the priests worked. And then there are, number 21, kitchens for the people. And these are the four corners of the temple compound. Kitchens. And there were special hearths there. So that the people have a hearth in the holy places and it's well laid out, and they then can cook. For the people, it's chiefly the peace offering and eat it on the spot. And they're not some wee ad hoc little barbecue that they're bringing in or something like that. It's all fixed. And everybody would have heard that and said, that's a whole lot better arrangement. Why didn't we have that in Solomon's Temple? And then we've got nice pavings. Number 6 on the map there, the pavement. We've got nice pavings all around. And then we've got handy rooms or chambers for the priests and singers in the compound, and lots of them. And anybody who thinks about 1 Kings in the temple or the tabernacle, or who functioned as a priest or a Levite, or who came up to these holy places and saw how the whole thing operated, would have looked at this and they would have said, yeah, that's the way you do it. This is a whole lot better. Is everybody with me so far? Good. I want in this concluding section to slow down and sum it all up. Are you convinced that Ezekiel 40 through 48 is better than anything in the Old Testament post-fall? You know, land, temple, service, priests, Levites, people, circumcision, sanctity, and all the other things we've looked at. And the second point of that, can you see that someone in the Old Testament, Ezekiel's initial audience, because he's written this down, he's going to tell the people about it, would, if they were at all spiritually inclined, and they live in this world, this is how God has constituted Israel, this is his law, they would look at this as an object of hope. We've lost our temple, we're in exile, but the prophet has told us that there's something coming, and it's a whole lot better, and it's something to look forward to. Good in the future. Ezekiel's a priest, and Israel is a priestly people. They get this better than 21st century Christians would. And so this passage would and did appeal to saints in Ezekiel's day and in the centuries afterwards. They looked at this and they said, this is a beautiful vision. And they would have desired it. And they would have wondered, somewhat like you're wondering yet, what does this vision picture exactly? I know it's good, it's in the future, but in what way is it going to be fulfilled? And when? In other words, they would have said, I'm attributing to them quite a lot of sense here. They would have said, you know what Ezekiel's driving, looking at and been talking about, and my wife and I have been walking down the road and we've been discussing it, and we think Ezekiel 40 through 48 is dealing with God's law and how there are going to be big changes to it. Do you see that, dear? And then she'll give examples and he'll give examples. The law is going to change. It's going to be a massive shake-up in our world in ceremonial and civil law. Ah, but don't you see, dear? It's not only going to change, but it's going to get better. Because I've been thinking of this last night, and I think that word better really sums up what we have in this vision. And she says, because she doesn't want to let him off the hook too early, but when and how is this going to be fulfilled, dear? You know, I think you're getting near the truth, but I still want to know the fulfillment. What exactly is it dealing with? Because you say that it's going to be better, and I can see that. But are you saying that Ezekiel 40 through 48 is better than just the Old Testament? And now, in our terminology, therefore its fulfillment is the New Testament. Is it better than the Old Testament? Then its fulfillment is the New Testament. And then we're back with the book of Hebrews. Better. And Hebrews is saying the New Covenant in Christ is better than the Old Covenant of Moses. Or is it better than the New Testament age? And then the fulfillment is the new heavens and the new earth, because there is no interim period, sort of halfway between the New Testament age and the eternal state. Or, because she's a logical thinker, she says, maybe there are parts of Ezekiel 40 through 48 that are fulfilled in the New Testament. And maybe there are other parts that are fulfilled in the new heavens and the new earth, because that's an option too. And we will address these issues in our last class before family visitation, Lord willing, next week.